That's me setting off on my bike, shutting the door behind me, then cycling off down the road. It's a simple thing to do, and it's also the premise for this new podcast, getting out on your bike and cycling. Touring, professional, commuting, shopping, mucking around, it could be any of those or many others, a bit like cyclingeurope.org, where things are usually about cycling in some way, shape or form, often in Europe but more often than not elsewhere. And even a few things that have nothing to do with cycling or Europe at all. And there'll be something that falls into that category at the very end of the podcast, so keep listening. My name is Andrew P. Sykes, by the way, and I'm the author of the 3 cycling travelogues, Crossing Europe, Along the Med, and Spain to Norway, all on my bike, the famous Ridgeback Panorama, Reggie. We'll come back to the books later, or at least one of them, but over the course of the last 8 years, since I set off on my first long-distance cycle, I've had the opportunity of meeting lots of interesting cycling people, and hopefully, through this podcast, we'll get a chance to meet some of them, as well as explore some great cycling locations near and far. In this first podcast for September 2017, I'm cycling down the Calder Valley, close to where I live in West Yorkshire, crossing the border from Spain to Portugal in the hot summer of 2013, meeting up with some cycling enthusiasts in the Cotswolds and hearing from one of Britain's most influential female cyclists, Laura Moss, the woman behind the Cycle Touring Festival. Now, I was first inspired to get off my backside and go cycling across a continent because I was a bit bored one summer and came to the conclusion that there must be something more interesting to do than sit down and watch the TV. Others, however, have different reasons for embarking upon long rides. And my first interviewee, the first interviewee of the cyclingeurope.org podcast, is Tim McKenna from Leicester. Earlier this year, Tim cycled from the UK to Istanbul. Welcome to the podcast, Tim.
Thank you for having me, Andrew. It's lovely to speak to you.
Now, we'll come to the most recent trip in a few moments, but you kind of have an interesting backstory as to why you ended up doing these long cycles in the first place. So perhaps you could fill us in about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, I did a lot of cycling in my teenage years. I used to go off in the summer holidays, youth hosteling with a couple of friends. And at the age of 17, I cycled across the United States as part of the Trans-America Bike Trek, which at the time I thought would be the first of many such adventures. But unbeknown to me at that stage, I was already starting to exhibit the symptoms of what would eventually be diagnosed as bipolar disorder. So my life from 20 up until diagnosis in 2012 was pretty chaotic. I had a string of jobs. I was at a period of homelessness. I tried to take my own life on more than one occasion. And so during this time, the idea of sort of executing and planning a major bike trip would have been inconceivable. Fast forward to 2012, and when I was diagnosed, my psychiatrist said to me, exercise is such a positive benefit for mental well-being. So remembering my sort of teenage experiences, I borrowed a friend's bike and started pounding the country lanes, and it really did help. The idea to do the trips kind of grew from there, really.
So you had done this one Trans-America trip when you were in your teens, late teens, early 20s?
Yeah, when I was 17, I took part in it's a big fundraiser in America I don't think they do it anymore. It was for the American Lung Association, and there were myself and two other British guys went over and we raised a bit of money for the British Lung Foundation. That's how we ended up taking part. Yeah, I mean, that was the sort of one and only big trip I'd done up until 3 years ago.
So tell us about this this recent trip from the UK to Istanbul. Why Istanbul?
Somewhere I've always wanted to go, and it's kind of the starting point of Asia, the end of Europe. So, and I've sort of read a couple of blogs from other people that have done the same trip. So that it just seemed a logical place to pick as a destination and just set off.
So you set off from Leicester, and can you just kind of briefly explain the route that you took down to Istanbul?
Yeah, sure. I went from Leicester down to Portsmouth. And then I took the overnight ferry to San Malo on the Brittany, coast of Brittany, France. And from there, I went down to Angers, which is on the Loire River the Loire. I followed the Loire Valley all the way across France to the Swiss border. And then from there, I went up to hook up with the Danube, which I followed all the way across Germany, Austria, and Hungary. And then from there, I sort of headed south, Croatia, Bosnia, Montenegro, Albania, Kosovo, Macedonia, and then Bulgaria and Istanbul.
And had you visited the, especially the countries on the Adriatic coast, had you visited those prior to the cycle trip, or were they all new countries?
No, I've not been to any countries in Eastern Europe or down in the Adriatic. I'd read a lot, and I know people that have been down there, and they told me how stunning it is down there. So it wasn't the most direct route to Istanbul, but I definitely wanted to take in that part of the world.
So what was the highlight of the trip, especially that Adriatic coast bit?
The ride from Split down to Dubrovnik was pretty special. Followed the coast road, and it was lots of little tiny beaches and little coves and everything. But for me, I think Montenegro, the day that I rode from, well, the day that I arrived at the Bay of Kotor, and then the day I rode from Kotor up the climb out to the back of towards Cetinje, which is the old royal capital of Montenegro. I think that's a day that will definitely live long in the memory. It was absolutely, the scenery was perfect. People were really friendly, and it was just almost a day of perfection on the bike. I absolutely loved it.
And were you camping? Were you in hostels? How were you sorting out the accommodation?
A bit of both, really. Most of the time in Western Europe, I camped. France, Germany, Austria have amazing campsites with brilliant facilities at really reasonable prices. I think France, I was paying about €7 for a pitch, and these campsites have, one had a pizzeria, they have restaurants, they have, some of them had swimming pools, they've all got laundry. So, I mean, initially the plan was to wild camp a bit more, but just for €7, it didn't seem worth it. And then when I got to Eastern Europe and then the south, it was, accommodation was so cheap that I stayed a lot in hostels, so I'd get a room in a bed in a dormitory, or occasionally Albania, I treated myself to a hotel room.
How did you find the roads in Albania?
They were all right. Some of the driving left a bit to be desired, I have to be honest. I don't think they get a huge amount of cycle tourists down there, so I don't think they really know how to react on the roads. But yeah, Albania was quite challenging. It was 40 degrees when I was there, and I hadn't really done much research, so I didn't realise that I was heading straight to an area known as the Albanian Alps, which was incredibly mountainous. So I did suffer a little bit there, but it was enjoyable, though.
Yeah, Albania is a beautiful country. It's those Alps. I never actually cycled up those Albanian Alps, but I saw them from a distance, and they looked everything, or every bit the equal of the Alps, the real Alps in Western Europe.
Yeah, I think they've got, there's something like 7 peaks over 9,000 feet or something. So it's pretty comparable. Yeah, it caught me out a little bit, but type 2 fun we call it. So it was a bit painful at the time, but I look back on it with a lot of pleasure.
And if you had to do the whole journey again, is there anything that you'd change?
I went into it with a, because last year I cycled around the coast of Britain, which was I did that for Mind. So that was more of a challenge, and it was kind of, so I went into this still with my head on that this was a challenge, and I had a deadline. I had a flight booked from Istanbul to get back on the 15th of July. So about 3 weeks in, I had to sit myself down and say, look, because I already felt like I was racing against the clock to get to Istanbul, and I wasn't enjoying it as much as I should. So I had this kind of notion that I had to cycle every mile. So after about 3 weeks, I sat down, myself down, I had a chat with myself and said, look, if I need to get a train or a bus for a little bit, or I need to miss some countries out, it doesn't matter. This isn't a challenge. This is a holiday in all sort of all aspects. So I think things improved after that. So I think I would kind of relax a little bit mentally and try not to push myself so hard.
And did you end up taking a train or taking the bus or anything like that?
Yeah, I got a bus in Bulgaria, and I got an overnight train from, my original plan was to go from Hungary down through Serbia. Again, it was 40 degrees when I was there, and I just couldn't face it. I had three bad days on the bike and a bit of a wobble mentally. I kept trying to cope with the bipolar as well, and I had a bit of a low point. So I got the overnight train from near Zagreb to Split. So I missed out that little section as well. Came off the train at Split in the morning and set off down the coast of Croatia, which was amazing.
You mentioned there that you had a recurrence of the bipolar. How did you actually treat that in the short term while you're actually on the trip?
Yeah, it wasn't a full sort of blown. It was just, I mean, I still have highs and lows. It's bipolar manic depression, so you have soaring highs and incredible lows, and they're just, I think, when I push myself too hard physically, it impacts on me mentally probably more than it would other people. So I was at Lake Balaton in Hungary, and I just had 3 days off, found a really nice campsite with a swimming pool, and just chilled out for 3 days, and that kind of got me back on track.
And thinking about the future, have you got anything else planned in terms of future long distance trips?
Yeah, I mean, this is last year and this year, I really got the bug now. So I kind of like to, next year, 2019, I think, I'd love to cycle from Alaska to Argentina. That's the next big trip on the agenda. So I think it's about 18,000 miles, Prudhoe Bay down to Ushua, at the foot of Argentina. I think South America's a place that's always fascinated me. So
when will you set off and arrive? Because obviously you're crossing the equator there, and, you know, you've got to be careful with the timing.
Probably set off in July, I think. Alaska and Canada sort of in the summer. I think Alaska, the roads are only become passable at the beginning of June or the end of May, so it's quite a short period up there you have to do that stretch. And then probably the west coast of America in the autumn, which I think would be pretty stunning with all the trees and the colours and everything. And then, yeah, just keep going, hopefully 15 months for the whole trip.
And will you be using the same bike when you do the America trip?
Yeah, so I bought a bike for cycling around the coast last summer. I did quite a lot of research online, looking at various sort of recommended bikes, and eventually I settled on Oxford Bike Works, which is kind of a one-man band. A guy called Richard phoned him up, went down there and had a bike fit, and then selected a bike from his range, and the bike was absolutely brilliant, and I used it again this summer, and I imagine I'll use it for many years to come.
Does it have a name?
No, not like yours. No, sorry.
Well, you've got to think of a name for it for your next trip.
Okay, I will do.
Many thanks for speaking to us, and good luck on the next trip.
Appreciate it. It's a pleasure.
I really appreciated Tim being so honest in that interview. Few of us can really sympathise with someone who suffers from bipolar, but it's not uncommon to feel a bit down from time to time, and getting out on your bike can help. This is what Arthur Conan Doyle had to say on the matter of cycling and frame of mind. When the spirits are low, when the day appears dark, when work becomes monotonous, when hope hardly seems worth having, just mount a bicycle and go out for a spin down the road, without thought on anything but the ride you are taking. You can contact Tim, by the way, on Twitter at TimMcKenna5. That sound is not me getting shot, by the way. It is, of course, the slamming of my front door and me heading off on my bike, reminding us what this is all about. It's what Arthur Conan Doyle referred to, going for a spin down the road, and it's exactly what I did a couple of weeks ago here in Yorkshire. Don't jump. I'm about to slam the door once again. We've come to the Peace Hall in Halifax, which has only been open for about a week. Now, if you think of Halifax, you don't think of Georgian, Italianesque buildings like the Peace Hall. And I have to say that the Peace Hall is probably better made for TV than a podcast. Now, the reason I'm here is because I'm going to go on a cycle with Craig. We've kind of been friends on Twitter for years. Because he lives quite close by, we've decided to head off down the Calder Valley.
Sounds good to me, yeah. Maybe even a trip up Cragvale.
Well, I went past the hairdresser's, which has the temperature outside, and it's cracking the flags, and it's 14.4 degrees.
Well, I have changed clothes 3 times this morning already.
We're only a couple of minutes out of Halifax, and we're on something called the Hebble Trail, which is a really nice way of getting really into the very centre of Halifax, but it's a world away from the traffic on the main road, just a few minutes away, or just a few hundred metres away to the right.
This is perfect for people who are afraid to go out on the bikes because of the road traffic. Something like this is just perfect for them.
It is. It's and so few people actually know about it.
Yeah.
You know, I would imagine you ask somebody how to get to Halifax on foot or by bike, and they would say, "Oh, I've got to crawl up Salt Ebel Hill." But actually, you know, they don't know about this little bit of greenery.
Morning.
Morning. Well, and then we hit a traffic jam of people. Right, we've just come through the town of Sobey Bridge, which is deep Happy Valley territory. If you remember the police station and the bridge at the end of the series, I won't tell you what happens, but perhaps I've just given it away, I don't know. But this is where it was all filmed, this kind of stretch of the Calder Valley. Now, we've come away from the canal and we're making our way through a back lane. We're actually following, there's about two or three routes, aren't there? This is Route 66 of the National Cycleway. I think we might also be on Route 68, which is the Pennine Cycleway.
Yeah, I think that's somewhere up above us.
And there's various other routes. There's, let's wait for a car to go past. There's also a route called the West Yorkshire Cycle Route, or Loop, I think, which exists. I see signs for it.
Right.
And at some point, I think we might have already crossed it, but at some point you do cross the cross-country routes, the one of the Roses routes. Have you ever done that?
I've not, no.
No?
Don't do cross-country.
But, you know, in terms of cycle routes, if you want to follow a cycle route, there's plenty to follow around here. Or you can just do what we're doing and stick to the canal. You can, in fact, even follow the route of the Tour de France, which worked its way down in the opposite direction to what we're cycling today. And that takes you all the way down the Calder Valley. And we're just about to hit a really steep bit. And I'm going to stop talking, otherwise I'll be out of breath. Can be a bit tricky on these towpaths with the bridges. You know, obviously the bridges were not made for cyclists, and when the towpath thins, you do wonder who's going to be around the corner. I suppose you should use your bell, but mine's such a piddling awful little bell. That's a bit better. I think there are plans to actually for them to upgrade this. They're going to spend some money on the bit between Sobey Bridge and Hebden Bridge. Have you heard of that?
I have. So there were some plans published, I think, for doing the road up. It's not at its best, I'm afraid. But yeah, definitely under the bridges, it can be a bit scary, especially with the cobbles, with the wide gaps and the thin tyres.
There are parallels between cycling down the Col de Valais and cycling in Switzerland, because I remember when I was in Switzerland back in 2010, although the hills are obviously 5, 6, 7, probably 10 times higher than they are around here, in the bottom of the valley you had all the infrastructure. So you had the railway line, you had the motorway if there was one, you had a road, you had the river, and it was all quite a busy place. And I suppose it's a bit like that in the Calder Valley, because we've now moved across. Ah, perfect timing. There you go, that's the train, because we're right next to the train track. We're on a segregated, an off-road track next to the railway line. There's the road a bit to our right, although you can't hear it, and then you've got the canal and the river. So all this kind of infrastructure is crammed into the bottom of the valley, and it's easy to understand why back in 2015 they had all the problems with the flooding.
Yeah, I think every time they get heavy downpours around here, it's people hold the breath.
Yeah,
scary. You go into the shops in Hebden Bridge and there's markings on the walls saying the year and how high the water had come, but they're just pick themselves up and start again.
Yeah. Right, we've arrived in Hebden Bridge and it is raining a bit, which is a pity, and I think it's still 14.4 degrees. It's certainly no warmer. And we're sitting outside the White Swan pub, although we're having a coffee rather than anything else. But it's not a bad little place to visit, even on a wet, cold day in the middle of August. Right, so what's the plan from here? What do you reckon?
I definitely think we need to go up Cragvale now, the iconic Cragvale, and maybe stop for another coffee halfway up at Craggy's, maybe?
Yeah, that sounds like a brilliant idea to me. The problem that it is a problem cycling round the Calder Valley. It's not like cycling in the north of Scotland or cycling in the middle of nowhere in Norway or a place like that, because the problem is that probably every mile you've got another cafe where potentially you could stop and have a coffee.
Definitely, yeah.
Or even, you know, let alone pubs. I mean, if you wanted to go on a pub crawl...
I've only tried that once. Never again. I wouldn't recommend it. I'll stick to my coffee, thank you.
Well, the problem is, I think if you follow the towpath like we did, you'd just end up in the middle of the canal if you stopped and had a pint of beer at every pub we've passed.
And these pedals, that's really not a good idea.
But we'll go, yeah, we'll head up Cragvale, which... Is it the longest continuous ascent in England, in Britain? I'll read the sign at the bottom. Yeah, the sign explains what it is. And,
8.6 kilometres or something like that, I think, isn't it?
Right, OK. But it's never that steep. I always think it's kind of a bit of a cheat because it might be long and it gets extremely flat at some points.
I'm sure there are parts that actually do go downhill, but... I've never taken a spirit level, so I wouldn't like to say.
Yeah, a spirit level on a bike would be perhaps taking things a bit too far. But we'll climb up there, and then that takes us... The problem with... There is one downside, of course, to cycling up Cragvale, and that's the fact that you do have to, at the very top, leave Yorkshire and go into Lancashire.
Have you brought your passport with you?
And we'll perhaps visit the ice cream man if he's up there, and... And taste one of his 99s.
Oh dear.
We've come back on the road and we're now at the bottom of Cragvale, and we stopped at the sign just to clarify that question as to whether it is the longest continuous ascent in England or Britain, and it is in England. It says the B6138 Cragvale, longest continuous gradient in England. It rises 970 feet or 295 metres over 5.5 miles or 9 kilometres, which in the great scheme of things is not massive, but hey, it's still a good old climb to the top, 9 kilometres, and you certainly feel it by the time you get to the top. And the other thing that you feel is the change in weather. When I've usually cycled up here before, it's radically different when you get to the top. It's raining down here now, but it wouldn't surprise me if at the top of it's foggy and blowing a gale.
The reservoir has been known to disappear at the top with all the mist, and then if you try to cycle then down into down the hill, you sometimes have to pedal down the hill because it's that windy.
As predicted, the weather, we're not yet at the top, but we're halfway up the Cragvale, and the weather is just kind of five times as miserable as it was at the bottom. So I can only imagine it's going to get worse the further up we get, but we're about halfway up and we're at the Craggs Business Park, is it called? Craggies is the cafe. Now, normally when you're up here, you have a magnificent view across the wild, barren countryside, and you've still got the view. It's just a shame it's kind of shrouded in cloud. I think you can normally see Studley Pike from here, can't you?
It's just there. She's step forward a little bit.
Ah, yes, okay, you can see Studley Pike. It's hidden around the buildings. But there's lots of businesses up here, and it's quite a nice place to stop en route to the top of Crag Vale, especially on a day like this when it's kind of a bit miserable. Coming to the very top now of Crag Vale. I haven't mentioned this to Craig yet, but I'm going to ask him if he wants to cycle up Rippendin Bank, which is a challenge to say the least. But there we go, see what he says. We've now actually cycled into Lancashire, very little corner of Lancashire, but within a matter of seconds we'll be moving back into West Yorkshire and the long descent back down to Rippendin. Top. Where's the ice cream man?
I know exactly.
The ice cream man's not here.
Perfect weather for ice cream.
Yeah.
You've been shortchanged.
Well. Right, that was a rather wet descent, to say the least, down from the top of Crag Vale. And we're now in Rippendin, back on the Happy Valley Trail. This is where that woman got murdered in Happy Valley, isn't it? Rippendin. No? Off mic, I broached the subject with Craig of cycling up Rippendin Bank, and his reaction was?
Well, I couldn't really repeat it, but yeah, I'm looking at it now and let's give it a go.
Yeah, it's again another climb made famous for the Tour de France, and I think probably they went up it in how many minutes?
I haven't a clue, probably about five, I would think, if
five?
That.
I would have said more like probably two or three, but it's probably going to take us 15. It is very steep. At least when you're going uphill in the rain drops, they hit you at the speed at which you're travelling. So we've just got soaked coming down that hill at high speed. Yeah, so, and there is a good pub at the top, which we could pause at, of course. Right, so here goes, up Rippendin Bank.
We did make it to the top of Rippendin Bank, by the way, and the pub. Thanks to Craig for joining me on that ride. You can find him as well on Twitter. That's how I know him, and he's at Craig_238. I'm at Cycling Europe, by the way. Now, there's a good website for cycling in the Calder Valley, cyclecalderdale.co.uk, giving full details of all the routes we mentioned and plenty of others. Now, as I mentioned at the start, I'm the author of three travelogues. The first was Crossing Europe on a Bike Called Reggie, and the latest is Spain to Norway on a Bike Called Reggie. People have occasionally asked me if there will ever be an audiobook version made of any of the books, and the honest answer is I don't know. Who would read it? Me? Stephen Fry? Perhaps not. Anyway, I thought it would be good if I included in this podcast a short extract from one of the books, not read by me, but by someone connected to the extract itself. What you're about to hear is taken from my second book, Along the Med on a Bike Called Reggie. You find me near the end of the long, hot ride in Spain, and I've met up with my cousin Richard, who lives and works in Portugal, near the Portuguese border, and who better to read the extract than Richard himself?
Tuesday, 27th of August, 2013. Cycling day 49, El Portil, near Huelva, to Faro, 106 kilometres. I woke and peered outside from the confines of the tent. Once again, the day was starting with a grey sky, just as it had done 24 hours early in Seville. The material of the tent surrounding me flapped in the breeze. A few metres away was Rich's own tent, zipped up. I could hear the occasional faint snore coming from within. My cousin, a man famed within our family for his lack of enthusiasm for any activity taking place before both hands of the clock are almost vertical, was still asleep, I, on the other hand, am most definitely a morning person. I can't imagine how anyone who wasn't a morning person would be able even to contemplate a long-distance cycle such as the one I was about to complete. If I had started each of the previous 48 days of cycling at midday, I would have had to continue cycling late into the darkness of the night, or simply allow for an extra month to finish the trip. I sat down for a few minutes in the fold-up camping chair that Richard had taken from the back of his car. Over dinner the previous evening, we had discussed the possibility of replicating the arrangement of having him drive ahead and me join him later in the day somewhere along the Algarve. In the fresh light of the morning, I was having second thoughts. I had appreciated the help he had given me finding camping Playa La Bota, but after so many weeks of just figuring the whole thing out for myself, making last-minute decisions, feeling smug when everything went to plan and shrugging my shoulders and moving on when it didn't, I really didn't want the help and advice of anyone, however well-intentioned it might have been. Everything was packed and on the bike within half an hour or so, and the snoring from inside Richard's tent had been replaced by movement. A few moments later he appeared, bleary-eyed. We exchanged a few pleasantries, but it didn't seem an appropriate time to break the news that actually, having slept on it, I was going to do my own thing for the remainder of the trip, so I didn't mention it. I shamefully waved him goodbye, shouting the deceitful words, "See you later," as I pedalled off in the direction of the campsite reception. Later that morning, I would send him a text, diplomatically retracting my words. I grabbed an impromptu breakfast at a bakery in nearby El Portil and plodded steadily along the well-maintained, if rather narrow, coastal road. The wind was continuing to blow, and my average speed was pegged well below 20 kilometres an hour. After 10 kilometres, I was forced to move inland quite considerably thanks to the Rio Piedras. The authorities had never seen fit to construct any kind of bridge over the river in the final 10 kilometres of its journey towards the Atlantic Ocean. I thought back to all those beautiful, yet massively underused roads in the Greek Peloponnese, financed by European Union infrastructure funds. A slice of the cash might have been better invested here, to save me the effort of a sizeable detour. The move inland required me to rejoin a more major road, which weaved its way through much less attractive countryside and several towns with what appeared to be complicated one-way systems. They probably weren't, it just felt that way. When I arrived in the centre of the final Spanish town, Ayamonte, courtesy of the detour, I had actually cycled nearly 50 rather than the expected 40 kilometres, but at least I was there. The final place in the last but one country. The town of Ayamonte was a little disappointing. I had been expecting a fishing village with cliff-plunging vistas looking west along the Algarve. What I found was a flat town, strangled to the point of carbon monoxide poisoning with cars, trucks and buses, and filled with tatty tourist shops, food outlets and small supermarkets. Logic dictated that ferries require water upon which to float, so following the path of the river from the south of the port in a northerly direction should surely bring me to the point from which the ferry departed across the river to Portugal. It eventually did. Bobbing up and down in the river was the Virgen de los Milagros. Goodness knows who had thrown her in there, beside a sign saying Portugal por ferry. Without the sign, the Birken could have passed as a spruced-up fishing trawler. With space for only a handful, perhaps four or five cars, it certainly didn't resolve the puzzle as to why Ayamonte was such a busy little place. I was expecting a hefty tourist-inflated price for the one-way crossing of the Rio Guadiana to Portugal, and I had paused earlier at a cash machine to ensure that I had a sufficient number of euro notes to cover all but the most exorbitant of eventualities. I stood in front of the guy selling tickets in the ferry office next to the river, clutching a 50-euro note, hoping for the best but fearing the worst. €2.80. I was somewhat taken aback by the low cost, and my mood changed abruptly from one of expecting to be fleeced to one of being embarrassed that I only had a very large denomination note. Depriving him of a large proportion of his change, I apologised, albeit in English. I stowed away the notes and coins that I'd been given and pushed Reggie down the gangplank and onto the boat, where we too bobbed up and down for a few minutes on the water, waiting for the ferry to depart. I was more interested in looking across to the last of my 10 countries on the other side of the river than I was at looking back at country number 9. The river was wide, perhaps half a kilometre, but everything that I could see in Portugal was very low level. There were no high-rise apartment blocks, no riverside dock buildings, just a line of white constructions, most of them not immediately opposite where the ferry was berthed, but further south, nearer to the mouth of the river. Our destination was the town of Villa Real de Sant Antonio. Upon arrival, there were of course no border formalities. The smart one-story building with a pristine red-tiled roof and freshly painted white walls had, I assumed in the pre-Schengen era, acted as the border post. It had now been converted into a small welcome centre. I cycled past the building, and within seconds of having disembarked from the ferry, was standing next to the main port side cobbled road opposite, Cliff Richard? Hi, Cliff, I said out loud, as I raised my hand in response to his welcoming gesture. He was looking fit and healthy, and was holding a bottle of wine in his right hand. He was, however, looking very thin, very two-dimensional. I took his picture, and the convincing cardboard cutout smiled back. I'm off to my own high cliff at Cape St. Vincent, I quipped. He continued to smile, clearly appreciating the joke. As first impressions go, Villa Real de Sant Antonio was giving me some good ones. It was everything that Ayamonte wasn't. Pretty, well-kept, and there were some interesting buildings clearly dating back some way. Not too many cars on the streets, and a lovely relaxed atmosphere. I would even forgive the local council for having covered the town in cobbles, although I suspected that all they had done was to preserve, very well, the cobbles laid down by their predecessors. I had never given a second thought to the first town I had passed through in Portugal, so all this was coming as a very pleasant surprise. The original Villa Real was destroyed by the famous earthquake of 1755 that also flattened much of the Portuguese capital, Lisbon. The town was subsequently rebuilt in a grid pattern in just 5 months, and the fruit of the construction workers' rather rapid 18th century labour are still there to be appreciated today. So very often along my Mediterranean adventure, the area immediately around the border between countries was something of a letdown. Ayamonte had been a good example. Villa Real de Sant Antonio was quite admirably bucking the trend. It had even installed a septuagenarian crooner to welcome me as I stepped off the ferry. Bem-vindo a Portugal. Much of what remained of that first day of cycling in Portugal wasn't pleasant. There was too much traffic. There were too many bumps in the road. And there was too much wind. And not only was the wind blowing in what I considered to be the wrong direction, it was cold. Yes, cold. Not even cool. Cold. I had, of course, the Atlantic Ocean to thank for that. Perhaps when cycling from Seville towards Huelva on the previous afternoon, the gusts had had a little time to warm up as they blew across the arid pastures of southwestern Spain, their large metal balls and heliostat mirrors. Here in Portugal, close to the coast, the wind was coming straight from the sea, and at times it was sending shivers through my body. I couldn't really do much about the wind, but the traffic and perhaps even the bumps could have been dealt with. At the bottom of my map, I had written the words, cycle path along the Algarve, but had chosen not to follow it. Known as the Ecovia Litoral do Algarve in Portuguese, it links continuously the town of Villa Real de Sant Antonio with Cape St. Vincent, and it would have kept me away from the busy N125. My only reason for not making use of it was my, perhaps misguided, desire to get to the end of the journey before sunset on cycling day 50. Had the route been anywhere else, I would have at least given it a try. Should I ever find myself cycling along the Algarve coast again, I would certainly follow it from beginning to end. An opportunity missed. Tomorrow, cycling day 50, would see me back in the tent, at a campsite in Sagres that I had been looking forward to visiting for several years, not because of what it was, but because of where it was, just 5 kilometres from the end of the long cycle path from one corner of the continent to the other. The journey was nearing its end. The lighthouse at Cape St. Vincent was calling. And should all go to plan, I would be sitting in its shadow in less than 24 hours' time. Well, if I had a plan worthy of the name in the first place.
Thanks for reading that, Richard. To find out if I did make it to Cape St. Vincent, you can read the book, of course. All of the books are available from Amazon, and the latest, Spain to Norway on a Bike Called Reggie, which was published by Summersdale earlier this year, is widely available in bookshops. Okay, well done for making it this far. We're currently about 40 minutes out of a total of 60 minutes in, I reckon, and we're not doing too bad. So far we've cycled from the UK to Istanbul, we've cycled in the Calder Valley of Yorkshire, we've also just heard about cycling in Spain and Portugal, and we're now going to head off down to the south of England to the Cotswolds, and I'm going to hand over to me sitting in my car. Summer has finally arrived in Britain. It's Thursday morning and I've just driven down from home down to the Cotswolds, to Morton in Marsh. And the reason I've come down here is because I've been invited to speak at an event, an annual event, I think, held by the CTC, or rather Cycling UK as it's now called. And it's a week-long event. They go riding during the day and in the evening there's films and talks and bits and pieces like that. So tonight I'm talking. I've got the bike with me, however, and I'm going to be camping here for 3 nights until Sunday morning to take in, hopefully, some of the rides along with the CTC members. And that was about it when it came to what I knew about the Birthday Rides event. I'd been to the Cycle Touring Festival earlier in the year, and I imagined it to work along similar lines. For example, I was camping, just like I'd done back in May at the Cycle Touring Festival. But apart from that, I didn't really know the ins and outs of the history or how it worked. So the first person I went to speak to was a chap called Peter Matheson, and he's the Birthday Rides Coordinator. This is what he had to say.
When the club was approaching its 100th birthday in the early 1970s, people of the day decided to have a series of annual gatherings, and generally the idea was to move to different parts of the country. It was primarily a camping event, but as people have aged, there's been more tendency to want indoor accommodation. I mean, the fundamental purpose of the birthday rides is that people meet friends, and some people who are here this week in particular have been coming to the birthday rides almost forever, and they see long lost friends who, when they were young with their families and camping, and now they're in their 80s and still coming and enjoying it and meeting up.
Peter went on to say that in the 70s and 80s, large groups of cyclists would head out into the countryside together on organised rides, but in the more recent times that's become a bit more tricky because of traffic conditions, and nowadays they provide the rides and people head out either individually or in small groups to explore the countryside for themselves. So I now had a much better idea as to what the Birthday Rides event was all about. I'd still yet to meet any cyclists, however, but shortly after pitching my tent I did recognise a couple of faces, and they were those of Anne and John. I'd met Anne and John at the York Cycle Rally earlier in the summer, and I asked them to explain what the birthday rides meant from the perspective of cyclists.
I'm Anne Lawther, and I'm from Halifax in West Yorkshire. And I started cycling as a child. My parents were both very keen cyclists. The first bike I had was obviously the Charles bike, but then age 6, my father put me on the back of a tandem. And I was a stoker of a tandem up until my early teens, and then I switched to a solo bike, and I've basically been cycling solo bikes ever since.
My name's John Stevens, I'm 62. I started cycling as a teenager, just casually, nothing serious. I've always cycled, but only more seriously in recent years, touring, camping.
It's good coming down with the Halifax section of the Calderdale CTC. There's good camaraderie. It gets you to know the members that you ride with on a regular basis that little bit closer. There's a good banter. There's obviously the actual cycling. The options, it's the opportunity to see new areas, to explore different places, and to interact with new members, because there's always the interaction with different members of CTC. And because it's a group, there's the obvious, you can spot people on the road, you sort of can clock the CTC members and usually have a banter and a chat and a catch and an exchange of ideas on what everybody's doing.
So the social side is just as important as the cycling?
The social side is every bit as important as the cycling.
This is only my second birthday ride, but I've done quite a few York rallies, similar kind of concept, and the social side is extremely important. And rather than meeting up with somebody on a day ride and you see them at 9 o'clock in the morning and you're there until late afternoon, you know, being with them in the evening, socialising, and that is, you get to know them better, and, you know, it is it's an important part of the club.
The following evening, it was the turn of Frank Burns, serial cycle tourist, to give a talk about one of his rides from the UK to Istanbul. I caught up with Frank the following morning when we were both putting our tents away, and I asked him to reflect upon the birthday rides event and the cycle touring festival that we both attended earlier in the year.
Well, Andrew, we're just coming to the end of a week of birthday rides, which celebrates the 139th birthday of the CTC, and about 460 people are packing up and getting ready to head off home after a week of cycling the lanes, sharing each other's company, eating good food, and of course, sharing the odd glass in the evenings. But there is a tremendous complementarity between what we do here in August and what happens at the Cycle Touring Festival. Because the people here are people who go to the Cycle Touring Festival. They are people who share the same interests, same passions. And because the age profile here is considerably higher, perhaps, than the Cycle Touring Festival, they would bring a lot of experience to the event. But they would also learn from the youthful enthusiasm for new trends and new ways of doing things. And I think that there's a tremendous complementarity between the two events. It would be nice to see birthday riders going to the Cycle Touring Festival, but equally, it'd be even nicer to see some of the younger generation coming to the birthday rides in August to bring down the age profile of the people here and just bring that new element of new ideas and new enthusiasm.
Those are the thoughts of Frank Burns, and you can read more of them on his website, Serendipities of Life, at www.frankburns.wordpress.com. Now, by the magic of podcasting, I've moved 150 miles north to Leeds, and I'm actually sitting very close to where the Grand Départ of the Tour de France took place in 2014. In fact, I think it's the last time I was in this little corner of Leeds, and the reason I've come back is to meet up and have a chat with Laura Moss, who is the woman behind the Cycle Touring Festival. So welcome to the cyclingeurope.org podcast, Laura.
Very nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me along.
It's an absolute pleasure. Now, we're going to have a quick chat about the Cycle Touring Festival, and what I'd first like to know is, how did it actually come about?
So a couple of years ago, my husband and I cycled 13,000 miles around the world. And before we set off, we'd spent a long time reading blogs and emailing people who'd done similar trips to us before to get advice and to find out what kit we needed to take and which countries were safe to go through. And I'm the kind of person who really likes face-to-face contact. I'm not very communicative on email and so on. So we decided that instead of having to rely on email and website to plan this kind of trip, it would be a great idea to bring people together into one place. And there's two functions of it, really. It's to share knowledge and experience to help those who want to go and do their own trip, but it's also just to share stories from the road so that people who've had these experiences can come together and share the experiences they've been through.
So what actually happens over the course of the weekend?
So it takes place usually over bank holiday weekend in May. So it's 2 or 3 days, and it's this whole series of talks and workshops. And it's a mixture of inspirational stories where people get up and show us photographs and tell us stories about their travels. And then it's alongside that, there's quite a lot of practical sessions as well. So everything from how to fix a puncture and how to do a roadside bodge when you're in the middle of a run with no spare tyre, to how to plan a route across France, or closer to home, we do quite a lot of sessions about, say, route planning in Scotland, or best routes to cycle across Europe, which is something that you've very kindly done for us before, Andrew.
Indeed I have. And when it takes place next May, will it be different in any way from the first one? How has it changed over the 4 years that it's now been running?
Well, I think if anything, it's just got better. We started the festival as a non-profit volunteer-led event, and we've stuck true to that. Because in the very first year, we realised quite quickly, within about 10 minutes of the event starting actually, that the best thing about it was the fact that it was community-led. And I have a real strong belief that everyone has a great story to tell. Anyone who goes out on a bike and does an overnight trip, whether it's one night or whether it's several years, has a story to tell about that adventure. So the principle I stick to is that we don't have headline speakers, because everyone has a valid story to tell, and it creates this really wonderful community of people actually, where there's no hierarchy, and everyone treats each other equally, and everyone listens to each other, and that's not something that's changed. We've kind of stuck to that principle all the way through. In terms of what's changed, I'm not really sure, to be honest. I think if anything, it's got better. We've perhaps got a bit more professional because we know what we're doing now, whereas in the first year we didn't. We just made up as we went along. My mum does all the food, and as much as I've tried to discourage her from doing that, that's still the case. So perhaps what we have stuck to, what has changed perhaps, is that we do more sessions now on trips that are closer to home and shorter trips, because we've realised that my husband and I are the exception rather than the norm. I mean, Andrew, you've been often done big long trips, but the vast majority of the people can't, for whatever reason, whether they've got work commitments or family commitments. So we try and not have too many talks and sessions now that are focused on those very big life-changing trips, and more on the sort of weekend and week-long adventures instead.
And how can people get involved?
Well, tickets probably will go on sale towards the end of October, if all goes to plan. The event next year is in May, early May. We also are running a couple of regional events this year to try and keep the spirit of the festival alive during the rest of the year. The group of people who come along are just some of the best people you'll ever meet, so I didn't want to just have that restricted to a once-a-year opportunity. So we've got an event running in Devon in the next couple of months that a couple of people that come to the festival are organising, and then hopefully a couple of other festival attendees will be organising them between now and next May as well. So details of that are all on the website.
Who's your target market for the Cycle Touring Festival?
Anybody really, anybody interested in travelling by bicycle. So we define cycle touring as journeys of one night or more by bike, so cycle, sleep, repeat. So anybody who's interested in that, whether you're 4 years old or 100 years old, and we really do have that age range at the festival, and all sorts of people come along.
I think it's fantastic, and I think it's one of the, certainly in my current life, it is one of the highlights of my year. So I'm very much looking forward to attending next year. But there's something else that you're involved with, which is something called the Adventure Syndicate. Could you explain what that is and who is that? Who that's aimed at?
Yeah, so the Adventure Syndicate was founded about a year and a half ago by two pretty inspirational women called Lee Craigie and Emily Chappell. And Emily she was one of the people who inspired me to set off and cycle around the world. And she then spoke at the Cycle Touring Festival in the first year. And her and Lee decided that they wanted to, in their words, put a bomb under the bike industry, because the bike industry is so focused on men, and bikes are often designed for men, and then if they build a women's version, they pink it and shrink it. So they wanted to really change the minds of the bike industry about what women are capable of. And it's not just the bike industry, it's women themselves. So it's making women see what they're capable of by inspiring them to achieve more. And it's not just women, actually. We've found since we started that there's lots of men out there who are perhaps a bit nervous for whatever reason at cycling, either cycling further than they've ever cycled before or doing a big adventure, which they perhaps wouldn't naturally do.
And how do people get involved with the Adventure Syndicate?
Well, we've run a series of workshops and events over the last year and a half. At the moment, we've not got anything immediately on the horizon coming up, but we There's lots of talks happen throughout the year. The website's probably the best place to go to, and you can sign up for the mailing list and find out our social media details. One of the biggest joys actually is following the women who are our syndicateers, as we call them, as they go off and do these crazy adventures, cycling across the Tour Divide in America or taking part in the transcontinental race across Europe.
So aside from the Cycle Touring Festival and the Adventure Syndicate and, of course, your job, I know that you're a lawyer here in Leeds. Have you got any plans for any other adventures in the near future or even the far-off future?
I always have some plans. I've just come back from a long weekend cycling around the whiskey distilleries of Islay, which was a superb way to spend a few days. Early on in the year, I did a trekking trip across Lake Baikal, frozen Lake Baikal in Siberia. So that was the big expedition for this year. We've got a vague idea to go and cycle across Jordan perhaps next year, or perhaps Namibia if we can save up enough money. But no firm concrete plans as yet. There's always something on the horizon.
Well, whatever you end up doing, good luck. And I think on behalf of everybody who's been involved with the Cycle Touring Festival as a attendee or a speaker or anybody, thank you for making it such a fabulous weekend.
Oh, thank you for coming. It relies on the speakers, actually. I just have to get everybody there, and the speakers are the people who make it. So thank you, Andrew.
Many thanks to Laura for sparing the time to do that interview. She's a busy woman and it was much appreciated. You can find out more about the Cycle Touring Festival at cycletouringfestival.co.uk. It takes place from the 4th to the 7th of May, and I highly recommend it. For more information about the Adventure Syndicate, go to theadventuresyndicate.com. We're coming towards the end of this first podcast, so thanks to Tim, to Craig, to Richard, to Laura, and all the people at the CTC event in the Cotswolds. If you've enjoyed what you've just heard, then help spread the word about the cyclingeurope.org podcast by encouraging friends to listen as well. If you think you might have something to contribute, feel free to get in touch via the website cyclingeurope.org, via Twitter at cyclingeurope, via Facebook, search for the cyclingeurope.org podcast, or by email podcast@cyclingeurope.org. I'll be back on October 1st with reports from Brussels, the bike show in Birmingham, a chat with Barry Godin, cycling filmmaker extraordinaire, and hopefully I'll be chatting to a professional racing cyclist, plus another extract from one of the books read by, well, not me. To finish with, however, remember at the start I said that I might include things that had nothing to do with cycling whatsoever. Well, one of the best things I did this August was to make a spontaneous decision to drive up to the Yorkshire Dales to climb the Three Peaks of Yorkshire. 30 minutes after coming up with the idea, I was out the door, and early the following morning I recorded this. Now, I've travelled widely in Europe, both on a bike and on foot. And I have to say, this morning's walk from Horton in Ribblesdale to the top of Ingleborough equally ranks with any of those previous walks. Beautiful countryside, deserted countryside. It's Monday morning. It's now nearly only 10 o'clock. I set off at 7. I only met two people on the way up, and that was near the top. Fantastic views, beautiful views in the sunlight, the hazy sunlight. It's not a perfect day, but it's a very, very nice day for walking. High clouds, and the sunlight's not too strong. The summit itself was misty when I arrived, but I'm sitting here in the shelter, and periodically the mist has moved aside and I'm looking west now towards the Lake District, and you can see the peaks of the rest of the Dales and the Lake District in the far distance, and it really is beautiful. So don't neglect what's on your doorstep. Yesterday morning, 24 hours ago, I was sitting at the computer working away, tapping out another article for the website. And I just made that instant decision to get off my backside and come and do something a little bit adventurous. And I don't regret for one second having made that rash decision.